The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God. This is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Rex Factor. This week, Robert II. With your hosts, Graham Duke and Ali Hood.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome to Rex Factor, reviewing all the kings and queens of Scots, from Kenneth MacAlpin to James VI. So, Robert II, perhaps not a name that's going to ring a lot of bells, but he is the first monarch of the House of Stuart.
Ooh. Okay, so we're getting there, aren't we? We really are now. But that means that this is our last dynasty, then.
It is our last dynasty, indeed.
Oh, well, this is rather a sad day.
A poignant moment. Yeah. But thankfully, there are plenty of Stuarts for us to get our teeth into, so we're okay. Not done with them yet. So we're going to do a quick bit of backgroundy stuff in terms of the House of Stuart, how it is that they come to be ruling Scotland, and then we'll get into Robert II and see if he can impress a bit more than David II, who you weren't really a big fan of.
He annoyed me so much, and it's perhaps a little unfair. And the people on Facebook were certainly more forgiving than I was, but by the end, I was just, someone get rid of him.
So, the House of Stuart, we've got a couple of interpretations in terms of where they come from.
Mm.
Firstly, the Shakespearean version.
Oh, right.
And actually, we've technically covered this before, because it was in Macbeth.
Are they that old?
Well, in Macbeth, the legend is that he is speaking to the witches.
Yeah.
He's concerned about his one-time ally Banquo. So he says to the witches, "Yet my heart throbs to know one thing. Tell me, if you art can tell so much, shall Banquo's issue ever reign in this kingdom?" Whereby the witches tell him that Banquo will never reign, but they present an apparition of a long line of Banquo's descendants, which include 8 kings. So Banquo won't reign, but his descendants will be kings.
How much are we to take that what he's writing there is propaganda, given that he was writing in the time of a Scottish king?
Of James VI, yeah. And James I of England. Certainly there is a propagandist element there. Right. But actually, to be fair, Shakespeare was basing this on kind of contemporary histories that predated James becoming King of England.
Right.
So it was actually believed for a long time. So what happens is that Macbeth arranges for the murder of Banquo, but Banquo's son Fleance escapes, and thus from him is descended the Stuart dynasty,
right,
ultimately come to rule. So it's not actually until the 19th century that it's properly disproved by an historian that there's no foundation for Banquo and Fleance whatsoever.
Those jolly historians, they ruin everything.
Though to be fair, there isn't a known individual in the Stuart dynasty prior to the 11th century. And Macbeth is, of course, in the 11th century. So
yeah,
you never know. Maybe there's a nugget of truth.
Is this,
yes,
right?
So what we do, the actual origins as we know about them, are that they are a Norman family.
Mm.
So the first known individual is a chap called Flard.
That's just a noise. What should we call him? Flard. Okay.
I mean, to be fair, you were getting to that stage when you had your naming.
I was, yeah. I was that tired.
So his brother was a steward or seneschal to the Counts of Dol in Brittany. His brother didn't return from the Crusades with Robert of Normandy, the eldest son of William.
Yeah.
So Flard becomes the steward. But then his son, Alan FitzFlard, is recruited as a mercenary by Henry I of England. And he's later appointed Sheriff of Shropshire.
Right.
Because being from Brittany, he speaks Breton, which is, has certain similarity to Welsh. So he must yeah. be able to
oh, that's interesting.
Speak the lingo. He then becomes a courtier, and then we get Walter FitzAlan, i.e. his son, who becomes mates with David I of Scotland.
Right.
And David I of Scotland was a protege of Henry I, so that's yeah. kind of the mix of those.
So they're climbing the social ladder a bit there.
So Walter FitzAlan supports Matilda during the anarchy in England.
Yeah.
Then after that, he joins David in Scotland, and he's appointed the first highest steward of Scotland.
Because he was sort of on the winning side there in the end, yeah. the English. And you mentioned before, Stuart is a sort of a corruption of steward.
So apparently the word steward comes from the Anglo-Saxon stig, meaning hall, and weird, meaning guardian.
Oh, like, and is that where we get the word ward from, to be a... ward of to be a protection of something.
Yeah, the guardian, somebody's guardian. Oh. So it's a high office. Yeah, it's a high office of state. So it's kind of responsible for the management of the royal household. Often has a military command,
right?
As well, but it's the third high steward in Scotland that adopts Stuart as a surname. But it's initially spelt S T E W A R T.
Is it?
We now would spell it S T U A R T.
Yeah.
So it's only when we have Mary Queen of Scots and she goes to France and the French struggle to pronounce it with a W. So she changed the spelling just to make
that's,
it a bit easier on them.
Because I'm sure I've seen it spelt both ways, actually. Mm.
Anyway, what about Robert II?
Yes.
He is the son of Walter Stuart, who is the sixth High Steward, and of Marjorie Bruce, who is the daughter of Robert the Bruce.
Okay,
so
right.
he's the grandson of Robert the Bruce. Mm. And he's born on the 2nd of March, 1316, which means that he's nearly 55 years old when he becomes king in 1371.
Good grief. Which oh, is, that's because David clung on for so long, isn't it?
Yeah, so the weird thing was, he was grandson of Robert the First.
Yeah.
And he was technically the nephew of David II, the previous monarch, but he was actually older than his uncle.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You mentioned that last time. So it's just primogeniture that took precedence there rather yes. than... Okay, right, oldest boy.
So... we don't have a portrait of Robert II. Mm. We're getting near to the era where we will have portraits, actually. I think once we get to the Jameses, we will have actual images. But we always have the Heritage Playing Card Limited artist interpretation. Ali, what are you expecting?
Plenty of tartan, given what we were just talking about, the hat. I'm hoping someone a bit more boss-like, his grandfather.
Yeah.
Less David. Mm. Trying to think what was going on the last episode. Warry
stuff.
I'm thinking a nice cocked hat, tartan trousers, sword.
Let's see.
Right. I have to say I wasn't expecting that. Seriously. He has a... I mean, if you were to cover that head... it wouldn't be out of place if you were to put like Elizabeth I's head on that.
Yeah, definitely.
Was he a cross-dresser?
Not that I think we're going to be covering, but again, that's one for your PhD thesis.
Yeah, well, I mean, the evidence. I'd base it all on the Eight of Spades Heritage Playing Card. I better try and describe this. It's a long, flowing, tightly fit sort of bodice section. But the bottom half is long flowing, and he has sort of wizard sleeves, very high fluffy collar, and it's midnight blue with sparkling stars on it.
No tartan.
No tartan, no sword, no cocked hat, though he does have a little crown, but he doesn't look very happy with the get-up, I've got to be honest. he's looking like he's been dressed up. Yeah. Oh, good grief.
Does he look wary?
No, not at all. He looks concerned. In case anyone sees him in his finery there.
Oh, I suppose. And this won't work for anybody other than those of us in the room, but by the Eight of Spades, you did, of course, mean...
clubs! Yeah.
So, in terms of his early years, his grandfather, James, was the fifth High Steward.
His grandfather
was called James.
I thought it was Robert.
Grandfather on his father's side.
Right.
His paternal grandfather... the Stuart line was James the Fifth High Steward, right. And he's one of the original guardians of Scotland who was appointed in 1286 when Alexander the Third died, and it was all a bit uncertain about
and
who was meant to be ruling.
You did the theme tune,
and I did that theme tune. So he was an early supporter of Robert the Bruce, but he died in 1309. So then Robert II's father, Walter, fought at the Battle of Bannockburn when he was only 18 years old, got knighted straight afterwards by Robert the Bruce, and obviously was well favoured by the Bruce, because a year later he gets to marry Robert the Bruce's only child and daughter, Marjorie.
Wow, that's an enormous honour. What did he do at the battle? Must have. Do you reckon it's possible he saved Robert the Bruce's life at one point, like in the middle of a battle?
He definitely wanted to give him some rewards.
He did, didn't he? Because that's the biggest reward he can get. It's his biggest bargaining chip.
Because at this point, yes, that's his only child and heir.
Wow. I'm going to assume that he saved his life.
Okay. So Marjorie Bruce, mother Robert II, was imprisoned by Edward I in 1306.
Sorry.
She did narrowly avoid being put in a cage, but only just. Sadly, though, she's thrown from her horse while heavily pregnant.
Oh, gosh.
And went into premature labour and died apparently after a caesarean section.
Oh, which is poor woman in those days.
She's only 19 or 20 at this point when she dies, which also tragically exactly the same age as her mother when she died giving birth to Marjorie. So it seems to have been something in the family. So Robert never knows his mother.
And his father is still about?
And his father dies in 1327, towards the end of Robert the Bruce's reign. So this is when, I've already forgotten, he's just 11 years old at this point.
Oh, gosh.
So he's put under the guardianship of his uncle, and he's brought up on Stuart lands in Bute, Clydeside and Renfrew. So he's perhaps a bit more Gaelic in character than David II, because he's in Stuart lands kind of to the west, a little bit more to the north. David II becomes king when he's only 5 years old in 1329, but Robert is 13.
Right.
So Robert's on the verge of manhood whilst David is in his his awkward minority. Unfortunately, as you recall from last time, we had Edward III of England launching an invasion of Scotland. So Robert was actually involved in the fighting of this. He led a wing in a major defeat in the Battle of Halidon Hill in 1333 when he was just 17 years old.
Wow!
He fled to Dumbarton Castle, where David II and his wife also went. David gets sent off into exile in France, but Robert stays and becomes Guardian of Scotland. So he's appointed alongside John Randolph in 1334, and they seem to have quite a tense relationship, this other noble of some power. In 1335, Robert's lands were under siege and Randolph was captured, so Robert actually submitted to Edward III at this point.
Probably wise,
but instead the Scots appoint Andy Murray as Guardian.
Yeah.
And he leads quite an impressive recovery and gets a lot of Scottish lands back. And what's more, Edward III gets busy starting the Hundred Years' War with France, not focusing quite so much on Scotland. Andy Murray died in 1338, so Stuart was restored as the Guardian and Scotland is secured, so it's safe enough for David II to come back, which he does.
Time and time again.
However, they seem to have developed an immediate antipathy. So as you said, David II, he's younger than Robert, despite being the uncle. But until David has children, Robert is his heir.
And he's more successful.
He's got some military experience and he spent a lot of time building up a pretty strong power base in Scotland.
I like this man.
So David seems determined to oust Robert.
Earliest convenience.
He seems to have considered establishing his nephew, John of Sutherland, as a potential heir instead of Stuart, but he never quite manages it. So David spent lots of time building up a rival power base in this court of sort of chivalry and all this kind of stuff inspired by his time in France, but then suffers a heavy defeat at the Battle of Neville's Cross in 1346 when he invades northern England. Randolph, the other rival, is killed, and then Robert Stuart fled the field, probably expecting to go home and become king.
Why would he assume that?
He assumes that David's going to be killed in the fighting.
I'm liking this guy more and more. I would definitely assume that as well.
So he would have been quite annoyed when he discovered that despite suffering a couple of arrow shots to the face, David survived and was captured by the English.
That's the one thing in all of my dislike of David that I keep forgetting. He did get shot in the face by an arrow. It's amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
So, Edward III has now got David II prisoner in England. So, Robert Stuart is appointed guardian again, and he kind of adopts the mantle of the patriotic cause, because David, trying to get himself released, has all these kind of schemes that he's doing, becomes quite busy mates with Edward III, and David proposes having the Plantagenets, the English royal men, named as his heirs.
Yeah.
So when David dies, initially Edward III, but then probably more likely John of Gaunt, his third son, or one of his other sons, will become King of Scots. David thinks, well, I could still have kids at some point, but bonus is I'm getting rid of Robert Stuart.
Yeah.
Robert Stuart thinks, well, I can't have this. I'm not going to be king. So he's like, well, look at this guy trying to make the English kings. This isn't what my grandfather fought for. Let's reject this.
Yeah.
So Robert does basically all he can for the next 11 years to stop David getting released.
Yeah, and it's a more attractive cause to Scots, surely. Mm.
And he builds up his estates. He makes strategic marriage alliances. He's basically just making himself really powerful again.
He's just doing perhaps what David should have done. He's being quite an effective ruler here.
Well, he's doing what David was trying to do, but David kept
getting it wrong.
1357, David was released for a 100,000 mark ransom.
Sheesh.
And he sought to immediately offset Stuart power and once again build up an alternative power block in Scotland. So he marries a woman called Margaret Drummond.
Where's she from?
Well, she's got her family and her initial husband, who's bought off, and then also her father's family. Both of those have got a lot of rival sort of landed territories near the Stuarts.
Yeah, okay. We covered her, didn't we, last time?
We covered her. Robert Stuart leads, or is part of, a failed rebellion in 1363.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really brought to heel a bit by David at that point, and his prospects are starting to look a bit bleak. David, having tried to get rid of Margaret Drummond, unsuccessfully as it turned out, was preparing to remarry with another Scottish family whose lands would threaten the Stuarts. Robert Stuart is, of course, now into his 50s. You'd expect him to die soon because, you know, at that time. But, incredibly, in 1371, despite only being in his 40s, David II died suddenly without having any children.
What did he die of again as well?
We don't know. Maybe it was complications from his injuries that had never quite healed. Maybe he...
Face injuries.
His face injuries.
I still...
Well, head injury, I suppose, as well. You know, yeah. He suffered headaches and stuff. But so, without this seeming likely to happen at all, in 1371, becoming 55 years old, Robert II... Well, Robert Stuart now becomes Robert II.
That must be our oldest king.
I think in Scotland, I think that is the oldest exceeding monarch we've ever had. Now... There's a bit of a debate about his physical state at this point.
Yeah, right.
Some chroniclers suggest that he was worn out, old, which I suppose he was, and suffering with eye problems.
Probably true.
So, one, he was young, he was quite rash, quite precocious, as we saw, he was a little bit Machiavellian.
Mm.
He's now a little bit more kindly, sort of peaceful old chap.
Really like him.
According to Walter Bower, author of the Scottish Chronicon.
Brilliant.
He said he was humble and gentle, friendly in appearance, a cheerful man, an honourable king, witty in his responses, admirable in the way he carried himself, surpassing others in stature and the height of his body.
Well, I mean, that's Edward I he's describing there, surely. I mean, you can't tell here because they're all drawn to the same size on the card. Hmm. Maybe he's hiding quite some long legs there.
Maybe. Potentially, he's quite a friendly chap.
But
maybe that's because he's getting a bit old. He's not quite the force of nature that he was maybe in his 30s and 40s. Maybe it's come a bit too late.
But he does have that history, so it's all in the tank there somewhere. I like him.
He does have a difficult time in terms of what David II has left him, though. The nobility is very divided. David's been, you know, playing around with them for the last 40 years, trying to get his power source. And there's something of a Damocles sword in terms of that ransom that the Scots have still got to pay off to Edward III. And, of course, Edward III could still threaten to invade and enforce the Plantagenet succession.
Sorry, the ransom was for the release of David.
It was, but they haven't paid it all back yet, and Edward III is potentially going to still expect that to be paid off. A bit like war reparations, I suppose.
Okay, even though the other fella's dead.
Yeah.
And it might just give him an excuse to invade anyway.
Exactly.
Right.
And what's more, Robert is not universally popular. He's made enemies. Because we've seen it's a very factional court in Scotland during the reign of David II, so it's not necessarily the case that Robert is going to be just acclaimed as king, particularly because he's somebody who was seen as a noble who would never actually be king.
Yeah.
Which isn't an easy transition to make. And indeed, apparently, as soon as he became king, he faced some kind of opposition from a chap called William Douglas, one of the border lords, who made some show of force in opposition to Robert's succession.
Why? What was in it for him?
Well, it's not really clear. It's unlikely that he was actually claiming the throne because his claim would have been so convoluted, whereas Robert was so obvious as the grandson of Robert the Bruce. Probably he was trying to ensure his position at court and indeed his territory. He may have feared that Robert would try to sort of steal lots of lands of him and other people and just...
Given his past, that seems reasonable.
Exactly. But Robert knighted William's son, James, and arranged a marriage between James and one of Robert's own daughters.
Wow.
And probably a bit of a territorial agreement as well. So Robert's going to try and be a bit more conciliatory and bring the nobles on side in a way that David didn't.
Okay, yeah, good move.
So, he does become king.
Yeah.
And he has a major advantage over David II. David, despite all his marriages, was unable to produce any children.
Yeah.
Robert II has got children by two wives.
Oh, he's, yeah, right, okay.
So initially married to a woman called Elizabeth Muir in, well, sort of married in 1336, but because of all the chaos of the wars with England, they don't seem to have really had a proper canonical marriage.
Why?
Well, I guess they just never quite got round to it. I suppose a less polished version of that might be to say that he was just kind of sleeping with her and not actually married.
Right. Can I, if you'd excuse me, just to... Hello to you, Robert. It's been a while since we had a nice, juicy bit of scandal. So he... Are we to assume that then those heirs are...
Well...
You know,
during the captivity of David II, pretty much the first thing Robert Stuart does is write to the Pope.
Yeah.
Rather than petition for David's release, Robert petitions the Pope Clement VI to legitimise his marriage with Elizabeth Muir, and indeed his to legitimise his...
Marriage.
Legitimise his children. I suppose, in fairness, you know, maybe they got married when it was all quite warry and all quite chaotic, and they maybe weren't able to, you know, get the right bishop in place to sign all the documents...
Get the correct witnesses because they're all out stabbing each other.
So anyway, that is successful. So his children are now legitimised.
Okay, right.
His first wife dies in 1355. So then, apparently quite soon afterwards, he marries a woman, Euphemia de Ross.
Quite soon afterwards? Are my fingers hovering?
It is fairly soon.
Right.
She was first married to his rival, John Randolph.
Oh, right.
So, unlike David, he's got an inbuilt support network just waiting to be used because he's got all these sons. And daughters.
Yeah, and he can flog the daughters off to make more alliances.
Exactly. Brilliant. So he grants major earldoms to his sons. So John, the eldest, becomes the Earl of Carrick and is kind of quite powerful in the south. His second son, Robert, becomes the Earl of Fife and is kind of dominant in the centre. And Alexander becomes the Lord of Badenoch and very powerful in the north of Scotland.
He's got it covered. This is a man who knows what he's doing.
And his daughters, like you say, he marries them off. So we've got marriages to John, the Lord of the Isles.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Western Isles. John Dunbar, the Earl of Murray. James Douglas, the one we mentioned earlier, who later becomes Earl Douglas.
Murray, then, is totally at heel now.
So he's marrying his daughters off to people around, you know, south, west, north. He's got people, his sons in the north, the centre and the south.
Yeah.
So suddenly he's got all these people in power.
Brilliant.
All ruling for him. So apparently 1377, 7 out of the 16 earldoms in Scotland were under Stuart control.
You can see why this dynasty lasted.
And by the 1390s, it's 12 out of 16.
Brilliant.
So that's either directly they are Stuarts or it's a kind of a marriage-y thing going on. Now, as we said, unlike David II, he didn't threaten existing interests in the nobility. So where he did transfer titles, he tended to provide pretty good compensation or give them another title. He even had some of his old enemies appointed as justiciars in Scotland.
Oh, it's so he's really even-handed.
He's bringing everybody in as much as he can. In 1371, he starts to look a bit broader, looks to the French for an alliance, shore him up against the English, and they sign a new defensive treaty, but Robert is keen to avoid actual war with the English.
Yeah.
So he rejects their offer to pay off the ransom that French would have then wanted to come to Scotland and have a joint attack on the English.
Yeah, yeah.
So instead he just gets a defensive treaty, they'll help.
That's much better. That's what they're after.
He's also quite lucky in that, unlike David II, who's fighting Edward III... from the very start of his reign.
Of course.
Robert gets him in his dotage, his final years, where he's not very active at all, possibly suffering from a stroke.
Yeah.
So in 1377, Edward III dies.
Okay. Look who it is. It's Joker. It's the Joker, Richard II.
By Joker, you mean...
Oh, you know what? Why I was put off?
You were thinking... you were interpreting with your historical knowledge...
I've got to take a picture of this as
and
well.
And also, to be fair, the picture.
Yeah, because I saw a J, and I saw Richard II, and he's got stripy trousers. He's got a stripy trouser shoe combo. It's all one thing, so it looked just like a jester.
Yeah. So Richard II becomes King of England in 1377, and he is grandson of Edward III, which means that he's only 10 years old.
Mm.
So this is a great time to become King of Scots. And indeed, there's not so much pressure on them. Robert stops paying the ransom.
Yeah, yeah, fine.
Now, although he doesn't want to have all-out war with the English, he does also, whilst publicly maintaining the truce, in private he's kind of giving tacit approval to the sort of more hawkish southern lords to do a spot of raiding.
Why is that? Just to sort of
push back?
Because
still garrison a lot of Scottish castles.
Oh, right.
Thanks
okay.
to when Edward III was doing all yeah. of his business. So he's giving the approval of those border lords in the south just to, you know, maybe I'll turn my back.
So they say, can I do some raiding? And he just carries on eating rather yeah. than saying no. Okay.
And then publicly you go, oh, no.
Naughty.
I'd never told them to do that.
Naughty lords.
They recapture Annandale from the English. And then a little bit of input from John of Fordon.
Good. Here we go.
In the year 1383, on the 4th of February, Lochmaben Castle was taken and destroyed by the Scots, to wit, the Earl William of Douglas and Archibald. Now, I've concluded this partly because it illustrates my point, but also, I'm afraid to say, that is the last entry of John of Fordon.
What happened to him?
He caught up. He has now become the history.
Right.
He has died.
Tell me he did some predictions. It'd be great if he sort of...
Here's what's going to happen next.
From now on, yeah. He said, oh, that'd be amazing. By the year 2000, everyone will own a book.
So I'm afraid that is our last Fordonism. So far, going pretty well.
Yeah.
However, things are going to take a bit of a turn, I'm
afraid. Oh, I definitely thought this was it now.
His sons are very powerful, which is great in terms of the Stuart dynasty establishing itself.
Is it Henry II job?
They're becoming a little bit overmighty. He's delegated a lot of authority, and they're starting to undermine his position.
Yeah.
His third son, Alexander, up in Badenoch in the north, becomes known as the Wolf of Badenoch.
Cool name.
He becomes notorious for employing Caterans, who are basically Highland brigands. So he extorts money from landowners whilst continuing to expand his influence across the north. And Robert II is criticised for his leniency in not dealing with Alexander.
So he's already taking an awful lot of from people by being the lord,
yeah.
and then he's just robbing what's left.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Down south, we've got his eldest son, John, the Earl of Carrick. So he's the heir and very dominant in the south, where we've got all the border lords who want war with England. They want to be raiding. They want to be fighting.
Yeah.
He's effectively getting a bit of a shadow administration
developing. Okay. Maybe a George IV equivalent, George
II.
Yeah,
sort of thing, yeah. So we've got all these people dissatisfied with Robert not dealing with the Wolf of Badenoch. We've got the Douglas, Lindsay, the border families who really want to do more stuff down south with England. There's kind of this developing tension.
Yeah, between keeping them in line by letting them do what they want and not having
and
war.
The problem is, because he's delegated so much authority and because his son is opposing him, he's now got quite a powerful enemy. In February of 1384, Douglas leads some raids into England. So in April, John of Gaunt retaliates.
Which one's Douglas? Douglas is the south one.
Yeah, so he's down in the south. So this is William Douglas. I think he's going to die soon and be replaced by his son James. But yeah, a southern border lord. Led a raid into England. In April, John of Gaunt retaliated and burnt the town of Haddington. So the border lords want to retaliate
for this outrage.
But Robert is keen to avoid the war because he knows there's a peace treaty going on between England and France and he wants to be part of it.
Right.
Consequently, he says no, joins the peace treaty. But Douglas led a raid in June anyway. So in November, Robert calls a council meeting to decide how they're going to proceed when the truce ends in 1385. However, the Parliament doesn't really go the way that he was hoping because his eldest son, the Earl of Carrick, turns Parliament against him, presents his father as being physically incapable of leading the country in war or dealing with the Wolf, the third son, in northern Scotland. Consequently, Carrick is appointed Lieutenant of the Kingdom and given, basically, power.
Didn't the king have anything to say about this?
Well, it's not clear if he opposes this and is just overruled because the whole council is against him, or perhaps he is getting a bit old and tired and is just sort of...
That's quite a change around. I mean,
shuffles off.
He had it totally sorted with, if everyone were if they're a happy family, that's an ideal end. But now they're dividing up again, because presumably now the brother of the South, that's now lieutenant, is against the Wolf in the North.
So one of his key pledges is that he's going to deal with the Wolf in the North do a bit more fighting with England in the South.
He's just your... If you want war, he's your man.
Exactly. So, we're not sure. I mean, he's 68 years old now, Robert. That is pretty old for a monarch in this period. So it's not clear whether he's infirm and senile or if it's just propaganda by Carrick. It's also not clear if he's still doing a bit of governing and Carrick is basically just in charge of saying, right, I'm saying we're going to war and I'm saying we're dealing with Wolf.
Yeah.
You can do some of the paperwork, but basically I'm in charge. 1385, the French send an army of over 1,000 troops over who join Carrick and Douglas, and they do a bit of invading in northern England.
Right.
But the commanders fall out, and the English, led by Richard II, actually, but probably mainly by John of Gaunt, do another one of those retaliatory raids.
Yeah.
Burn Edinburgh.
Oh, right.
Then in 1388, we have the Battle of Otterburn. Now, the Scots actually enjoy a victory here against the English and capture Henry Percy, more famously known in Shakespeare as Harry Hotspur.
Yes.
Son of the Duke of Northumberland. But, unfortunately, James Douglas, the new Earl Douglas, is killed in the process. Now, he was one of the key allies of Carrick. So Carrick has had this failed invasion in 1385 with the French.
Yeah,
he's lost one of his key allies in Otterburn. And when Douglas dies without an heir, Carrick tries to have him replaced with another one of his allies, but instead the earldom goes to a chap called Sir Archibald Douglas, who's the illegitimate son of that famous one in the reign of Robert the Bruce, the Black Douglas that burnt his own castle down. And Archibald Douglas is the ally of Robert the Earl of Fife, second son of Robert II. So we've now got the eldest son, Carrick, developing into a bit of a conflict with the second son, Fife.
And ongoing with the one in the north.
Ongoing with the one in the north, and the fact that technically Robert II is meant to be king.
Yeah.
So basically the Stuart men are at war with each other.
Yeah, what they did by getting this Carrick chap in was just voting for civil war.
And Carrick has not dealt with the Wolf of Badenoch at all. In fact, he's actually become more powerful in this period. What's more, in 1388, Carrick is seriously incapacitated by being kicked by a horse.
Ooh, nasty.
So he's not now actually able to do all of this kind of fighting and warring stuff.
So we're going to have a third one. Two kings incapacitated.
Well, in December of 1388, Fife has built up support among other members of the Douglas-Lindsay families, uses that dissatisfaction with Carrick and apparently his incapacity, their fears of another invasion to come from the English. So they have a council, and Fife overthrows his brother Carrick and becomes the new Lieutenant of Scotland.
Fife being the one in the middle.
Fife being son number two, has replaced brother son number one, who had replaced father.
But father's still technically king at this point.
Father is still technically king. Now, Parliament implies that Robert II is quite happy at this change. It's not clear if he's involved in it or if he's just a figurehead, just being kind of wheeled about by his various sons.
Yeah.
But he does apparently make a circuit of northeast Scotland after this.
Robert does?
Robert II does. And this also follows the Wolf in the north being removed as Justicia.
Okay.
So perhaps this is Robert, you know, going north and saying, oh, there's a new regime, it's all a bit better, everything's fine, I'm still king, hello.
Is he a bit of a spokesman at this point, rather than...
Quite possibly. After his little tour in the north, he returns to his home of Dundonald Castle in Ayrshire. And then he dies. On the 19th of April 1390, at pretty grand old age of 74.
Gosh, that's good, yeah. That's a shame.
I've
got to be honest. I was prepared for some seriously Rexy credentials there.
So, I mean, up to 1384, it's all looking very, very good. But then we get the sons kicking off, Robert not being able to kick back, unlike the horse.
That's a sad end.
It is.
And they dressed him up as a woman.
They did.
That's why he looks like he's not happy.
Battliness!
Some of the good stuff
for
Robert in battle. During the reign of David II, he does get involved in some of the fighting. There was a Battle of Halidon Hill in 1333. He's only 17 years old.
Yeah,
but he's given command of the centre of the Scottish army. It's a really brutal battle, terrible terrain for the Scots. They're marching uphill into this just sort of rain of arrows. And they suffer very heavy casualties. Stuart and Randolph, apparently, the only leaders to escape.
Ooh.
Now, it's not great in the sense that it's defeat, but it is a full-on battle.
And it is a learning curve for him at 17.
Hmm. Andrew of Winton presents him as a bit of a patriotic hero in the 1330s as a guardian of Scotland, helping to secure Scotland as guardian after 1338 when Andy Murray died. And in 1339, he managed to capture Perth Castle from the English. Now, in terms of the border raiding, unlike David II, he doesn't have a relationship with Edward III. So he does make that alliance with the French, and he's actually done so in 1350s as well to try and shore himself up against David II.
I think that's very good going.
But when he becomes king, he's a little bit more cautious. So the problem is, England are garrisoning Berwick, Jedburgh, Lochmaben, Roxburgh. They've got all these castles in the south of Scotland. Robert can't avoid all-out war, but at the same time, he would kind of rather that they were Scottish than
Yeah, he wants English. Them back nonetheless.
So he agreed to that defensive treaty with the French in 1371, covertly backs attacks on English-held estates, but publicly blames the border lords for disrupting the peace. But then when Edward III died, the raids become a bit more ambitious and his support becomes a little bit more covert.
But I don't think that did him any favours. When he was ousted, or at least presented as infirm, if he was publicly saying, don't do this and they were happening, that just adds to it.
Yeah, but you said not to do it.
I know what I said.
So 1376, they recover Annandale. 1378, Robert declares Coldingham Priory being part of Dunfermline Abbey's diocese rather than Durham.
Okay.
1384, the Douglases took Lochmaben Castle and Teviotdale, plus there's an attack on Roxburgh Castle. So we do see a certain amount of action going on against the English. And then in 1388, we have the Battle of Otterburn. Now, technically, this is after Robert's been sort of demoted or reduced to being a figurehead. But it's in his reign.
It's in his reign, and we're at the point, I suppose, where they're going to start perhaps taking less role. Oh, well, certainly for the English, we're at the point where they start taking less role.
Well, we're still in quite military. I mean, we're still, you know,
what year are we?
1388, this is, okay, so we're still...
Another 100 years, maybe.
Now, the background to this, the Douglas family, the Scottish Douglas family, is a preeminent border family in the south of Scotland. They've got a bit of a rivalry developing with the Percy family, who are in Northumberland, so the north of England.
Hotspur family.
Exactly. So, 1388, Douglas and Fife, second brother, launched a two-pronged invasion of northern England. So, the Percy brothers decide to target James Douglas, because he's got a slightly smaller force of about just under 3,000 troops. The Percys have got slightly more than that. So initially we've got the Douglas troops ravaging the countryside around Durham and Newcastle, but then Percy comes storming in and attacks them. So we have them fighting outside the walls of Newcastle. According to Jean Froissart, the great medieval chronicler of the Hundred Years' War and all that sort of stuff, Douglas and Hotspur actually fight in person.
Really?
And Douglas gets the better of Hotspur and captures his pennant, his little flag.
Does he have it on him, like a sort of tag team thing?
I guess so, yeah. Like in
that's hot. Yeah.
I've got the flag!
Run away! Wow, that's great. Not Robert, of course, but
well,
still.
Not Robert, but still.
Fun.
That's just the initial sort of skirmishing. Douglas and co are then retreating, but Hotspur tries to see off that retreat. So he rides through the night and surprises Douglas in an attack at twilight.
Give me back my flag, you rotter!
So the other Scottish leader, the Earl of March, faces the initial attack from Percy. But Douglas and his troops are hiding in the bushes. And they then storm out, surprise them, and attack the English advancing cavalry from the side.
Oh, okay.
Froissart declares it as one of the sorest and best foughten battles covered without cowardice or faint hearts.
They won that. They won the skirmish but lost the battle in the first place.
So the Scots win that initial skirmish.
Yeah.
And then they win this battle.
Oh, okay. Oh,
so
the other way around.
Percy, Hotspur, and his younger brother are both captured by the Scots.
Yeah.
And ultimately the English are routed. The downside, for Carrick certainly, and for Douglas obviously, is that Douglas is killed in the battle. Apparently it's remembered by a very popular ballad called The Ballad of Chevy Chase.
Griswold's family Christmas fame.
Indeed. Apparently, it was a hunting party on hunting land, this ballad. So the hunting element is the chase, and it was in the Cheviot Hills, helped.
Okay, yeah.
So there's some positives there.
There are, but... Well, when we come to review them, I'll...
But there are some all-out negatives as well as caveats to those positives.
Yeah, exactly.
The other aspect of David II's reign is that Robert's role is seen as being a bit suspicious by a lot of chroniclers. Other than Perth and capturing that castle, his record's pretty patchy.
Mm.
Halidon Hill is a big defeat. He submits in 1335, and then Andy Murray goes on and replaces him and does lots better.
Mm.
The Battle of Neville's Cross in 1346, many people see his flight from the battle, abandoning David II to his fate, as quite duplicitous.
Well, someone needed to do it.
He's not going down fighting, though, is he? He's heading off home. Every opportunity.
I love that he went home, presumably he saw David and went, ooh, and then went home. And David's there with his feet up with the telly on. What are you doing here?
The Lanarkost Chronicle said of Neville's Cross, if one about him and March, who both retreat, if one was worthless, the other was nothing. The Stuart, overwhelmed by cowardice, broke his promise to God that he would never wait for the first blow in battle, and he fled, turning their backs. These two fled valiantly with their force.
And fled valiantly.
A bit like Sir Robin, isn't
it? Yeah.
And entered Scotland unscathed, and so they led the dance, leaving David to dance his own tune.
Oh, very nice. Nice little metaphors.
We gave him a bit of credit for those raids into England that he gave that covert support to.
Mm.
But they did, as a result, face retaliatory raids, which probably did more damage than the Scottish ones. 1384, after they captured Lochmaben and Teviotdale, John of Gaunt marches all the way to Edinburgh, was bought off at that stage by the Burgesses and just went on to burn Haddington instead.
Yeah.
1385, we had the French sending over an invasion force, led by a veteran admiral, apparently, a chap called Jean de Vienne. 240 ships transporting over 1,000 soldiers.
Wow, that's quite an armada.
But the raids they made were pretty ineffective. They disagreed about strategy. The French really wanted a prolonged campaign, and the Scots obviously just didn't really fancy it. And we've got rather inactive kingship from Robert, as we've seen. He's perhaps lucky that he inherits the throne with the dotage of Edward III, the minority of Richard II, who's not that great a king anyway, and the English are distracted by France.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not good, Graham, is it?
When the French came over, Jean Froissart described Robert II in the greeting party for the French in quite uncomplimentary terms.
Okay.
Red bleared eyes of the colour of sandalwood, which clearly showed he was no valiant man, but one who would rather remain at home than march to the field.
Hung over then? Presumably.
Oh.
Hello, hello, we had a party.
I don't want to fight today.
Right, is that implying age as well?
Yeah, it's implying age, it's the eye thing, it's just that he's old and just really not up to the job.
Yeah.
And as king, really, we don't have any evidence of him personally engaging in military matters, and prior to that, we don't have really any great evidence of him being very successful.
So, in summary, I don't think it's very good at all. He's clearly... it's such a promising start.
Yeah, 17.
Before he was king.
Yeah.
And then the skirmishes that he was officially not even endorsing.
Yes.
Didn't even go well.
No.
And then overthrown, and there was some minor success, but he wasn't actually, you know, in charge of it.
Or indeed probably approving of it.
Yeah, true. Had no control over it, certainly.
There's a lot of propaganda going on with Robert II. So David II's allies very much do the propaganda against him.
Mm.
So we had the Lanarkost Chronicle. Jean Froissart spent some time at David's court,
right.
So he's biased against him. And then, of course, we've got Carrick, his son. So at both stages of his career, basically, he's being kind of done over a bit by propaganda.
Yeah, but he was overthrown by two successive sons.
Yes.
He
does have a bit of a tendency when the battle's on to kind of skip off. He just seems to survive a lot of defeats.
He does, doesn't he? Oh, that's that. Imagine having that reputation in those days. Surviving defeats would be quite the put down. I really wanted it to be good because he seemed like a decent bloke. He's taken advantage of by his children. I can't see it being higher than a 2, really.
No, I was just thinking maybe 1.5. I mean, we don't really have... There's nothing there that suggests he's particularly good in battle, even.
No. Can you imagine his joy when he did capture that castle? He'd be like, we're bloody, we've done it! This is a party!
You see?
You see? Yeah, exactly. And then the French arrived the next day and he said, I'm absolutely exhausted, mate. I can't.
So that's a 3.5 for battliness.
Scandal!
I dinged my bell.
You did ding your bell. The first thing I'll come to before we get to the dinginess is his dubious loyalty.
Okay.
He's a slippery so-and-so. 1330s to 40s, he submitted to Edward III in 1335, and he was then deprived of his office as guardian, because they obviously thought, this isn't really the guy that's going to do the business for us. He fled Neville's Cross, probably thought he was heading home to be king.
Yeah.
He then spent the next 11 years doing his very best not to help David get released.
Yes.
Shoring up his own position. And apparently there were widespread complaints of disorder when David returned, because Robert basically hadn't bothered actually governing the kingdom. He's just governing his own.
Removed all the W's from the keyboards.
Yeah. When David does return, he has a mistress, Catherine Mortimer, whose family were a bit of a threat to Stuart interests in Menteith. And she was assassinated in 1360 on the road. And the chap who was arrested as a conspirator in the murder was one Thomas Stuart, who was, I think, a bit of a distant cousin.
Right, that stinks to high heaven.
Certainly wouldn't have damaged Robert Stuart's interests for Catherine Mortimer to disappear.
Yeah.
And in 1363, with other rebellions, he was involved in an armed rebellion against David, admittedly protesting poor governance, which was fair enough, embezzling the ransom money, which was fair enough, but nevertheless, you know, this isn't a chap that's you can guarantee being in your corner.
I quite like him, though, because he's a survivor like that. I didn't like David, basically. But he is a bit of a survivor, and he was sort of doing what was necessary at the time to become king. But then when he was king, was less Machiavellian than when he was scheming to become king, and perhaps should have employed a bit more of those tactics.
Well, it's tricky when your own sons are the ones that are scheming back against you.
Yeah, he taught them well.
Let's get a bit more dingy.
Yeah,
your ding was because of his first marriage to Elizabeth Muir, where it turned out that he hadn't actually properly married her in the first place.
I think he married her in the euphemistic sense.
Yes. And then the Pope had to do it in a more literal way later on. The petition is quite interesting. It reads that Robert Stuart of Scotland, the king's nephew, carnally knew first Isabella and afterwards, in ignorance of their kindred, Elizabeth, who was herself related to Robert in the fourth degree of kindred, living with her for some time and having many children by her. The above king and bishops therefore pray the Pope that for the sake of the said offspring, who are fair to behold, grant a dispensation to intermarry and declare their offspring legitimate.
So they are just saying they weren't married and they were related and they got it on.
And there's also
and they've
this,
got pretty children.
And there's also this Isabella lady that he...
Yeah, beforehand.
The thing beforehand who's... Also, presumably.
So, on what grounds were they ever actually married?
Not entirely sure.
But then
maybe,
the Pope
maybe
just
he
said,
made some lovely promises.
They'd got all the invitations ready.
Yeah.
Just didn't get them sent out.
There's a bit of an invasion going on. Yeah. It just, you know, it's awkward.
That's incredible that that the Pope can just do that. Just say, okay, yeah, you were married.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
That's why Henry VIII gets so annoyed.
Fair enough, yeah.
And also, I mean, it's not massively scandalous, but his second wife, Euphemia de Ross, was the widow to the chap John Randolph, who'd been his arch rival
like
in the 1330s to 40s.
Yeah, I really like that.
So he moved straight into his enemy's
widow. It feels
widow.
A bit like Henry II and Philip.
Yeah.
Your
enemy's divorcee is my new potential wife. Now, Walter Bauer has something to say on this.
Mm.
It is not a matter for rejoicing on both sides if a king or prince fathers a son who is not the offspring of a marriage, but merely of pleasurable intercourse.
Sorry, I'm being such a child, but oh, they do have a way with words.
And he's saying this a little red-facedly because Robert II does have children by women who are at no point his wife.
And are they self-employed, shall we say?
Well, we've got at least 4 illegitimate children by Mariotta Cardoni, 1 by Maura Leach, and at least 4 by various other women. So he has at least 8 illegitimate sons, and possibly more daughters that they didn't bother to write down.
Right. Okay.
That's, given that David II didn't have any children at all...
That's good going,
Robert II has at least 8 illegitimate children.
Yeah. How many... Oh, we'll get on to... offspring.
Indeed. So as Alan Massey said, whatever his deficiencies in battle and his feebleness in the council chamber, Robert was active enough in bed.
That's definitely true.
So this is a bit better, I think, than Battliness.
That's an awful lot better. No wonder I like this man.
Yeah.
We've got some murder.
Yes.
As unlike other kings, he perhaps farmed it out, but he was in the crosshairs for that one.
Yeah.
We've got an awful lot of juicy, sexy bits.
Yep. And a bit of sort of disloyalty, treachery. Oh, yeah,
a bit of disloyalty, treachery.
Well.
Did he do any burning?
No burning, sadly. Burning
no.
Not there.
And obviously the other fella's wife.
Yeah.
But it's a nice simmering pot of your standard bit of... What's that? Oh, you've got a lovely bit of scandal on the go there. I'll have a bit. It would taste nice. It wouldn't blow you away, but it's a 4.
Oh, that's quite lovely. Less than half marks of scandal there.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking it's to really, really stretch this sort of soup metaphor that I've got going here.
Yes.
It's a lovely tomato soup. It hasn't got any seasoning in it, but oh, look at that. I'd want a little bit more, perhaps some robbery or something to take it up to a 5. What are you going
for?
Didn't
murder a bishop. Well, I was thinking of a 6.5.
Well, that would average him out close to 5, which is probably fair, isn't it?
So that's a 10.5 for scandal.
Hmm. Subjectivity.
Now this is it's a bit of a reign of two halves, really, for Robert II. The first half, it all looks pretty good from this perspective. First of all, he's got to establish a new dynasty, which is not an easy thing to do. And it's a pretty good achievement, the fact that he does do it. As you said, he wasn't universally popular when he came to the throne, but he's got all of those sons and daughters by which he's able to completely dominate Scottish earldoms.
Yeah, I thought that was great, that bit.
Really shores up the dynasty. So even when he himself comes a cropper, it's at the hands of his sons. It's not a rival family.
Yeah, it's like Napoleon putting all his close relatives into all those other kingdoms.
Yeah. In contrast, David II spent his whole reign trying to establish himself, building up alternative bases of power, marrying himself off because he didn't have any children.
Marrying himself. It's a sure way to get loyalty. What were you doing in that bedroom? I'm married.
Unlike David II, he doesn't set the nobility off against each other. It doesn't undermine local lordships, trying to give land away from one family to another, because it's fine, they're all basically his own family.
Yeah.
And the ones that aren't, he's able to keep them on side for a while as well. Apparently he sends out lavish gifts to some of his rivals. He compromises, as we saw with Douglas right at the start, when he rebelled and his son got a marriage to a daughter. So it's a much better way of approaching
things. First bit was great.
And it's also notable the fact we've got to remember the Bruce dynasty only managed 2 kings.
That's shocking, isn't it, really?
The Stuarts are there till the end.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, excluding once we link up with Britain and the Act of Union, but for the Kingdom of Scotland, the last dynasty is the Stuarts. They're there from this point onwards.
So what date is this? When does he start?
He's 13... I suppose we'll come into that later. Oh, okay. We're coming towards the end of the 14th century. So he dies in 1390.
And then James I is 1601 in England, isn't it? 03.
Act of Union, 1707. With Anne.
With Anne, and she's the last...
And she's the last Stuart, and that's the point at which England and Scotland become the United Kingdom rather than 2 separate kingdoms.
300-odd years.
Yeah.
Good grief.
And he's the one that gets it going at the start and sets it all up.
Yeah.
Now, he's not universally successful, of course, and there are various other problems and things for the Stuarts to deal with, but nevertheless, he did have to get it started and he managed it.
Mm.
Fair play to him.
Yeah, well done.
We also have evidence of him ruling pretty well at the start. Finances receive a boost once they don't have to keep on paying that ransom. Wool trade flourishes. Enjoys a healthy surplus of nearly £2,000 from an income of over £14,000.
Right.
Money's starting to pick up a bit. Now, David II has largely confined himself to southern Scotland and Lothian. But as you said, Robert Stuart had grown up in slightly more Gaelic areas in the west and the north. So he's a little bit more itinerant. In his style. He makes an annual circuit around the kingdom. Doesn't have to impose on the local lords, because there's all these Stuart residences everywhere now.
Yeah.
Lots of charters are issued from slightly more remote hunting regions, because he loved to hunt.
Yeah.
So as David's maybe a bit more stuck in a couple of places, doesn't see that much of the kingdom, Robert's maybe actually a bit more...
Maybe a bit more popular on the back of it.
Yeah, a bit more pan-Scotland. And also credit, I think, for avoiding getting dragged into the Hundred Years' War.
Gosh, yeah, imagine. Yeah, I mean, they don't have... They've got too much going on at home, haven't they?
And we have a few raids, as we mentioned, but there's no real invasion in the style of Edward III.
Mm.
It's just the English, when they get annoyed about the Scots invading, they just show them who's boss. But otherwise...
That's pretty true. To keep them out of the Hundred Years' War, that Wood was such the hot potato at the time, could very easily have got dragged in, especially with that 1,000 Frenchmen coming over.
And we saw what happened to David II when he gets involved and then gets captured at Neville's Cross.
Mm.
So it's rather better. And he doesn't have the succession woes of David II either.
No.
Just part of the problem. So as Walter Bower said, his times were prosperous by way of great abundance of provisions, fruit and animals, and especially the tranquility of peace.
Initially.
Initially, this is the problem. Because after 1384, of course, he is no longer really in charge at all. Now, there's great debate about whether he was a spent force at this time. He was 55 when he became king, and he's not going to get more vigorous and with it as life goes on. His health may be failing, his eyesight might be going. In 1384, when he's brought down, the Scottish Parliament recorded that our Lord King himself is unable to be attentive continually to the execution of justice and the law of his kingdom in person.
Is it a George III scenario? Is he? I mean, I can't remember what we did there when he was incapacitated. Did we give him credit?
We sort of gave him credit for stuff that's going on in his reign. That was a combination as well with the fact that they weren't that controlled directly in a lot of the events anyway. But so certainly that second half of his reign, it's not clear whether he's kind of no longer really got his.
I feel like he was capable and just lost it.
Lost support.
Yeah.
Even if he was healthy, as you're saying, he does seem to have essentially let his sons and local lords do their own thing. So Jenny Wormald, historian, characterised this as laissez-faire kingship.
Yeah, which does go a bit more hand-in-hand with this different character we see once he becomes king, a bit more laid back.
And that does basically weaken the strength of the crown, because the local lords are so powerful. So even if he's still with it mentally, he isn't really in control of events as much, because he has let other people do the bidding. So it does come back to bite him. And it does mean that he's got overmighty subjects. It's just unfortunate that they happen to be his own sons.
Yes, yeah. I do feel like he's dealing with John and Richard here, you know, trying to keep them at bay.
And he's also kind of storing up trouble for his successors as kings, because we've got all these really powerful lords, and as things go on, they're not all going to be immediately, you know, trying to become king, but they're going to think, well, I don't have to do what the king tells me, I'll just do my own thing. That's been established now.
Yeah, it's such a well-worn pattern, though, that they just divide and...
And, of course, let's not forget, he is sidelined by his first son in 1384 and effectively a second son in 1388.
It's pretty poor.
And in terms of law and order, in the north of Scotland, it's not so great with Alexander the Wolf of Badenoch.
It's really poor.
As we said, he's extorting protection money from wealthy landowners. The Bishop of Murray was so incensed that he preached against him from Elgin Cathedral.
Oh dear.
So he's got conflict with the bishops as well as everybody else. Robert's criticised for failing to curb Alexander's powers. And apparently Robert himself had been criticised for using Catterand by David II in 1368. So it's a bit of a pattern here. Yeah. Alexander's maybe his favourite, and it's maybe tactics that he learnt from his father. It's a bit of a sense of a mafia state, really. His sons are just able to do whatever the hell they like.
Yeah.
And the only fighting is really between them.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, subjectivity being, would you like to be his subject? If you have this disorder up in the north, similarly, whether it's actually supported on the quiet, you've got all the disorder in the south, which then leads to retribution from the English. If you're looking at it as a subject, it just looks like the king is just letting anything go.
And we saw in the 1350s when David was captured, when David comes back, he's got all these complaints of poor government and mismanagement and things. So Robert does maybe tend to look after his own interests and not actually...
Laissez-faire, that the historian had it right.
In his defence, once more, we do have to remember the propaganda element. In terms of all the complaints about the stuff going on in the north, we really see at this point a sort of hysteria and bias from writers in the south about the Highlands.
What, there was division there as well, wasn't there?
Yeah, so John of Fordon is one of these, and other southern writers. They're quite... they don't like the fact that Robert is Gaelic-friendly.
I can't believe they even... even want to exist as a nation of Scotland. There's so many individual divisions.
Despite two palace coups, the evidence does kind of suggest that Robert II, either by a bit of action or simply by his presence, keeps a lid on the dissent in the country. So actually the worst stuff of the wolf in the north actually happens after Robert's death.
Oh, okay.
So maybe a suggestion that by even just by being there, it's maintaining a certain amount of order.
Certain amount, but then there's the argument that he never sorts it out then.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But so we had certainly up till 1384, there's a lot of things to be impressed about. Let's not forget about what he does with the dynasty.
Yeah.
Keeping out of the wars.
I think that's the biggest one for me. Keeping out of the wars, the Hundred Years' War, and being basically randy enough to have enough offspring to put everyone in positions of power, which does come back to bite him, but it's setting up a dynasty if they don't start these factions again.
Yeah.
But there's those 2 points.
Hmm.
But on the other hand, if you were a subject looking at it on the ground at the time, you've got chaos up north, raids coming back to bite you in the south. It looks like total lack of control within his own family. At one point, he's sidelined.
Yeah,
I'll give him... I know this seems really harsh. I'm going to give him 2 for those 2 points.
Yeah.
Almost all of those are just because he starts a dynasty, and I think it's just luck, really, that it survives. Because it looks at this point that it'll all come tumbling down into brotherly fighting again.
I'm going to be slightly more generous and give him I was thinking about 4, but maybe we'll come down to 3.5. I think, cause like you said, it does just feel that he's not really that much in control. He's got enough energy at the start to sort of set up the Stuart dynasty. But it's almost like he then thinks, oh, well, I can just relax now. You guys can just take care of everything.
Because by that point, he is 60-odd.
Yeah. Which gives him 5.5 for subjectivity.
Oh, this is a shame.
Longevity.
So he is king from the 22nd of February 1371 to the 19th of April 1390. So despite his age, that's quite an impressive 19.17 years as king.
How many of those was it directly him?
Well, so up till 1384, so that's about 13 years.
That's
nearly
14
years. Yeah. So that gives him a score of 11 out of 20 for longevity.
Okay.
Which isn't too bad.
No.
Dynasty, not the program.
Well, as we know, he's active in the bedroom.
He certainly is.
He apparently had about 8 children by Elizabeth Muir and 5 by Euphemia de Ross.
Whoa.
Now, sadly, they don't all survive him.
Mm.
But he does, I think, leave behind 9 children.
Wow.
Which is just below the 10 of Malcolm III. But nevertheless, that's the second best that we've got for the Scots. And a score of 18.
Boom.
Out of 20. So he's done rather better for longevity and dynasty. Often these are the ones that can bring people down. But for Robert, it's been his rescue. So he actually gets a score of 48.5.
Which puts him...
That puts him 12th currently in the overall standings in terms of a total score.
12th out of what will it be our total number of monarchs?
Well, I mean, we've currently got 34.
Well, that's not bad.
But what does that mean for him overall? Does he have that certain something, that great achievement, that lasting legacy, that star quality that we call...
Rex Factor!
Do you know something I forgot to ask you?
What's that?
How did he die?
We don't know. I think just being
old.
Quite old by that point. He's not murdered or there's no hilarious...
He had a...
If only John Fordon had managed another 10 years, I'm sure he could have had a very colourful description.
I think it's fair to say he had a laissez-faire approach to life.
Yeah.
And that's how he died. He had a laissez-faire approach to life at the end as well. I thought, forget it. Okay, no.
I mean, I suppose really his lasting legacy, you could say, is the establishment of the Stuart dynasty. But he does inherit the throne. It's not like he conquers and forms a dynasty.
And yes, he does have a lasting legacy. And if this were a review of the dynasties of Scotland, the Stuarts would certainly be up there.
Yeah.
And perhaps it would be this chap sort of holding up the sign because he was the start of it. But I don't think he'd get it based on that.
Sadly for Robert II, I have to agree, it's definitely got to be a no. He had promised, perhaps, maybe earlier, if he'd become king, he'd have been better, but in the end, it's not all that great.
He just got it. He just had the timings wrong. He should have died at 60-odd, as most people were at this time, and been king from 17. Then it might have been very good. But
As it is, Robert II does not have the Rex factor. Let us know what you think. Get in touch with us on social media, on Twitter, at Rex Factor Pod. Like us on Facebook. Email us, rexfactorpodcast@hotmail.com, and go on to rexfactor.wordpress.com, read the blogs, and complete the polls on all the monarchs to say whether or not you think they deserve the Rex Factor. If you'd like to support the podcast, it would be very helpful if you could leave a review on iTunes and subscribe.
Yep, that's helpful.
You can do a one-off donation on PayPal if you'd like to give us a bit of help with the monies.
Yeah.
And recently we've had some lovely support from Bill Kirkpatrick, Joe Welsh, Madeline Gray, Ryan Chesley, Timothy 172, and Pete Tung.
Well, thank you very much, chaps. Kind of you.
You can also donate on a monthly basis via crowdfunding and join the Rex Factor Privy Council.
Oh, yes.
So you click the Be My Patron logo, and for $1 a month, you get a mention on the podcast. $2 a month, you get a comment read out. Mm-hmm. $5 a month, you get free access to our special episodes, which usually cost $2 to buy. $10 a month, you get a mug. $15 a month, you get to commission a blog on the subject of your choice. And $25... you get to commission a special episode on the subject for your choice.
And each of those increments, you get all of the stuff at the lower levels as well.
And all of those people get access to our bonus Privy Chamber podcasts, which are little things we do after recording this episode, after recording all the main episodes. We have a bit of post-episode chat.
Bit more relaxed.
Yeah.
I mean, not that we're particularly tense now.
But you get to sit down.
Yeah, I get to sit down. Okay.
So, welcome to our new Privy Councillors.
Oh.
J.K.E. Jarrett, Mary Bingham, Fiona Sanders, Journaling JB, Courtney Gwillat, Scott Freeman, Anna Hurley, Arthur Stewart, Post at Ina Elton, and Amanda Lett.
Hey, arise. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.
We also now have a new special episode out on Victorian engineer extraordinaire Isambard Kingdom Brunel.
The finest named engineer and Victorian ever.
It's quite magnificent. We've got all of his great projects like the Great Western Railway, the steamships.
The weird and wonderful train innovations.
Exactly, the Thames Tunnel, Clifton Suspension Bridge, all that sort of stuff and more besides. You can get that for just $2 a pop, as well as all of our other previous special episodes.
And that's quite a lot of poddy there, isn't it? How long is he? It's a couple of hours.
So yeah, like all the special episodes, they're all about just over 2 hours, so it's more than your regular episode. Yeah. So you get some minutes for your bucks.
Yeah, we sort of have a few more asides in those ones and are willing to travel off down rabbit holes.
Now we've had some messages.
Good.
This one is from Charles Hargrove by email. It took me a while to place it, but I finally realised why Ali sounded so familiar.
Huh?
He does a good Penfold from Danger Mouse with his frequent crumbs.
Penfold? Oh, my word. As a child, crumbs. As a child from the 80s, I have very fond memories of Penfold, but I'd rather think of myself as more the Danger Mouse character.
David Douglas James sent an email asking about Elizabeth II and the Scottish monarchs. And we've had a couple of messages about this. He's saying, one of my favourite parts of the English monarch series was how you noted how each monarch was related to Elizabeth II. Presumably, since Elizabeth II is descended from James VI and I, you could do the same thing for all the Scottish monarchs. So I've had a little look at this. The reason I stopped doing that, I wasn't 100% certain about whether or not the website was definitely accurate that I was using. But as a
little guide.
Kenneth MacAlpin is the 33rd great-grandfather of Elizabeth II.
Right.
Compared to Alfred the Great, who is the 32nd. Macbeth is the fourth cousin 27 times removed, apparently.
Is there a website you just plop this in?
There's a website which features it for some of the Scots, not all of them. Robert the Bruce is the 19th great-grandfather. And then the one we've just done today, Robert the Second, is the 17th great-grandfather, Elizabeth the Second.
I'm sort of surprised. I thought it would be more than that. But I suppose if each one lives for, on average, 60 years or something. Yeah.
We should also note that since we last recorded, Elizabeth II has become the first monarch to, in our country, to celebrate the Sapphire Jubilee.
Really?
65 years.
Because we did a big one for the 60th, wasn't it?
Mm. It well, there wasn't any big grand celebration
for it. Was that 5 years ago, was it?
Yeah.
Good grief.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course, the Olympics. Yeah, yeah.
And I had a message about my pronunciations from Claire Custard Rampage and helped by Scott Thompson at Alpen Viking. Apparently, what I was saying as Buchan should be pronounced as Buchan.
Okay.
Or Buchan. So it's a hard K.
More hard cheese.
Yeah. And also, Burr, as I've been saying, should be Burra.
Oh, that's weird. Because usually that's Burr down here, isn't it?
Well,
like
that's
Edinburgh.
What I was because, yeah. And yet, on the other hand, in England, the Burrs, as I've been saying, obviously become
Burrs. Yeah.
So I don't know if we've been...
London Borough of Hackney or something.
So I don't know if we've been mispronouncing the Saxon ones or if it's in Scotland that it's pronounced Burr.
You know, oh, gosh, Burra. That's confusing.
A couple of reactions to our podcast on Robert the Bruce.
Yeah.
Which went down very well with quite a few people, particularly some of our Scottish listeners. And this one on Twitter, @SciencePie.
Good handle.
Probably my favourite episode of both seasons.
Oh.
Definitely not sitting here applying war paint or anything. Weeks of Ali barely able to contain himself at our subjugation. It's great to see him get all his Edwards and eat it. No shame.
Oh, funny.
And Sue Clark, @SueClark57, asked, why is his middle name The?
Good one.
Is Bruce a title? I should have answered this really on the podcast, but originally it was Robert de Bruce.
So is
the for the previous ones. Well, it's more of Bruce. Okay. De as in of, so it's of the Bruce family. But we've, for whatever reason, translated that into the for him.
Oh, that is slightly weird, isn't it?
It sounds a bit cooler, though.
Yeah, it sounds a lot cooler.
Mm. We had a few reactions to Robert the Bruce's digital face, as reconstructed by Liverpool John Mills University on Facebook. Sophie Wing says, he looks like he's going to tell me it's only a... some of these in relation to his card.
Yeah.
I'll do that again. So we've got some reactions to Robert the Bruce's card, as we described last... some reactions to Robert the Bruce's card. Sophie Wing says, he looks like he's going to tell me it's only a flesh wound.
Absolutely he does. Yeah. This is Monty Python Holy Grail background reading.
Margaret Burt says he looks like a dancing extra from Spamalot.
Again, background reading, Monty Python.
In a kingly way. And James Hook, I'm not sure if this was about the card or about his digitally reconstructed face, which is pretty menacing. Now I know why Edward II liked ditch digging.
Yeah, it was a lot more straightforward. Mm. Digging his own grave.
Yeah. And some messages from some of our privy councillors.
Yes.
Mark Craster Chambers apparently has his own podcast called The Teller.
Oh, right.
Which is a storytelling podcast, if any people want to go and check that out on iTunes.
Stories that he's written, or...?
I'm not sure if he's written or if that he's telling, so he's okay. Narration for. Yeah, so if you'd like to go and check that out...
Sounds good.
Please do. Mark Summers said, due to your efforts, I now get a smile every time I pass our office automated external defibrillator and hashtag
Oh, yes!
Aya. Keep up the great work, Ali and Graham, or is that Gandalf?
Because we were just only today talking about defibrillators.
Yeah, because I've been
everywhere.
Doing first aid training, but yes, yeah. an AED. for us, it's Ayath, but for...
Everyone else, it's a life-saving device.
Indeed.
It's another way he's right there in everyone's faces, but no one can see it. Yeah. Well spotted, that man.
Scott Freeman said, I realised early in the Scottish series that Terry Pratchett based a set of characters in his Discworld series on the Picts. He had them be small, tartan-wearing fairy folk and called them Pixies, the wee free men.
Oh, that's quite... I mean, they're a bit harder than Pixies, aren't they?
Melita Pendergast on Braveheart said that according to IMDb, when asked by a local why the Battle of Stirling Bridge was filmed on an open plain, Gibson answered, the bridge got in the way. A local answered, that's what the English found.
Oh, that sounds quite a lot like urban legend, but I really hope that's true.
And Amanda Lett says, you boys are doing a great job of keeping me company while I work on my PhD.
Ooh.
I want to give a shout out to my friend Caitlin Mead, who told me about your podcast in the first place. Keep up the good work and congrats on the baby, Ali.
Thank you very much. Let us know what your PhD topic is. That sounds interesting.
So we've had a mention of your baby there.
Yes.
And we also mentioned the awkwardness of naming and flard.
It's tricky.
Dynasty. Lots of people sent in suggestions. There were a lot of Edgars, a few Dunstans.
An awful lot of Edwards.
Yeah.
And to be honest, he was in the front running. Obvs. Because Oh, God, I'm tired, Graham.
It's the talk of baby instantly.
Yeah, I just remembered his happy, screaming face. But tricky with the surname Hood.
Very tricky.
Edward Hood. Not as bad as Edward Woodward. So we went for something similar.
Mm.
Rupert.
Rupert, as in Prince Rupert of the Rhine.
Yeah, and if you Google him, you see he cuts a very dashing figure, hoping he lives up to. But we had to get a slightly more Rexy name in there, in the middle, so we had a George for the middle.
Classic George, replacing the Stuarts, of course.
Yes, yeah. And for the surname, we played it traditional and kept mine, which isn't terribly Rexy, but I suppose it's a bit sort of Robin Hoodie when we see Richard I.
I mean, Robin as well got a lot of suggestions from people.
I genuinely really like that name. It's in fact, my brother nearly had it as a middle name, but he is Christopher, so it would have been Christopher Robin and then Robin Hood.
Oh, that would have been amazing.
So, yeah, there we are. He's very, very lovely. But apologies for my absence on Facebook recently, and I will get back to it. Life has been rather busy.
So that is Ali's baby, and that is Robert II.
Mm.
Thank you. Vince.
Oh, by the way, Rupert is German for Robert.
Is it?
Yeah.
Ah.
And there we go on that bombshell.
Yeah. So anyway, that's it for Robert II. He doesn't have the Rex factor. We will see next time if we can be a little bit more successful with the Stuart dynasty.
Who is it?
Well, that might be telling because we've got a bit of a complex situation, haven't we? We've got Carrick overthrown, Fife in charge, but.
Yeah, that sounds trouble. Spells
What's
trouble.
Happen? See you next time.
Cheerio!
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Sound the gifting panic alarm. You need to get an amazing gift. Wait, no, the perfect gift. Relax. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With Capella University's FlexPath format, you can set your own deadlines, learn at your pace, and access most coursework from anywhere at any time. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.